Hello, listeners, and hello, audience. Welcome to Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. As you can hear, this week we've come right into the crowd, out of science's ivory tower and into a shopping mall. We are at the International Science Festival in Gothenburg, Sweden. Thank you so much for coming. Can I get you to say hello, Crowd Science? Can you say it in Swedish?
Hey, Crowd Science!
Fantastic. Crowd Science is the show that takes listener questions and turns them into audio adventures. I'm Marnie Chesterton, and I'm delighted to be joined this week by Camilla Widerbeck from Swedish radio's show Vetandetsvärld. Please tell me I got that roughly right.
Not so bad. Vetandetsvärld. It means world of knowledge. And like you, we are trying to make sense of science for our listeners. And today I'm very happy to be joining Crowd Science to help you look into this week's question.
Thank you, Camilla. Yes, this week we've got a great question and a very knowledgeable panel who are going to get their teeth into it. We'll introduce them shortly, but first, here's our listener Elizabeth with this week's question.
Hello, Crowd Science, and hello to you all there in Gothenburg. I'm Elizabeth Crayford, and I'm speaking from Wellington in New Zealand. My question is, why do we appreciate beauty? The human face, gorgeous landscape, lovely music. Why do humans find it so appealing? I'm particularly interested in why we appreciate coordinated movement and symmetry, like huge flocks of birds flying in formation, or shoals of fish moving together, or coordinated dance troupes. I'd really like Crowd Science to explore whether this is some sort of universal truth, this is the symmetry of the universe, or whether it's given us some evolutionary advantage.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Why do we appreciate beauty? I also want to give a shout out to Sigridur Kristjansdottir from Iceland, who sent us a very similar question about the scientific basis of beauty. This is obviously a big question, and we've got half an hour. So, panel, could you introduce yourself and tell us one thing that you find beautiful? And I'm going to be mean and say you can't pick your partner or your kids.
So, hello, I'm Elvira Brattico. I'm a neuroscientist and professor at Aarhus University in Denmark, originally from Italy, but I've spent part of my life in Finland. And actually, one thing that I love and I find extremely beautiful is the pine tree part of the nature. It's really important for me.
Thanks, Elvira. Roger.
My name is Roger Antonsen. I'm an associate professor of informatics from the University of Oslo. And I'm also a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. My PhD is in mathematical logic and proof theory. I love patterns. And one thing that I absolutely love are Celtic knotwork. I don't know why, but it's so beautiful.
Yes, and my name is Louise Sankovic-Fries, and I'm a dance and choreographer. I'm Danish, but I'm based here in Sweden. And at the moment, I work on choreography and AI. So, big question, what do I find beautiful? The word beauty, it has a lot of expectations on it, but I always appreciate a good tree, like Elvira. I'm a nature girl, not only what I see, but what I feel.
Thank you. That is our panel. Can you please give them a big welcome? For myself, I'd probably pick Table Mountain. I was recently in South Africa and got up to the top of this amazing mountain and just had one of those connections with nature where your heart just, there's that lurch. And so I'm really excited to know what it is producing this effect in us. Camilla, can I ask you, what's your beautiful thing?
Actually, I'm going for nature as well, but I can't really choose between sunset at sea, in the Baltic Sea, among the islands of the Swedish coast, and my furry Siberian cat. But
I'll let you have both.
You'll let me have both. Yeah. Well, thanks. Well, the thing is, there are so many different things to choose between and so many different kinds of beauty, and that makes this quite a tricky subject to cover in half an hour, as you said. But we're hoping to get some insights into what's going on in our brains when we experience beauty, if there are any evolutionary reasons for appreciating beauty. And the theme of the Science Festival this year is about human and artificial intelligence, so we're also going to look at how far machines can recognize beauty. So that's all coming up.
So, maybe, first of all, we need to attempt to define beauty. Elvira, this is a tough question. Over to you.
Yes, indeed, it's really tough. But if we want to say it really briefly, we can summarize by saying that beauty is that special property of objects, of things that we find appealing, that are satisfying, and to which we attribute positive judgments.
So is it something that we learn to appreciate, or is it something we're born with?
It's both. So there are some features of landscape or music or painting that are innately beautiful. So they actually are triggering and inducing pleasant emotions in us. But on the top of that, we also learn to find new things, new beautiful aspects in the stimuli. So to appreciate more and more features that in the beginning can be unpleasant.
You mentioned pleasure there. And as a neuroscientist, you study people's brains, and specifically when they're listening to music. Can you tell from that whether they're experiencing beautiful music?
Yeah, we can tell that, actually. We have a few studies where we ask people to judge music according to beauty or ugliness, and we also measure brain responses. And common to these studies is a special part of the brain that gets activated. And this part of the brain lies just below our forehead, between our eyes, and it's called orbitofrontal cortex, and it's medial part, which seems to be activated when we find the music beautiful. And it's very consistent among participants and among kinds of music, and also cultural experience, so cultural background.
Now, I should plug Crowd Science's back catalogue. We made a programme about what shapes our musical taste, which was fascinating. You can find it wherever you find your podcasts. But Elvira, you mainly research music. As far as our brains are concerned, does it matter whether it's beautiful music, or could we have the same response from, say, a beautiful landscape?
It does matter, of course, and it's related to the connections between this part of the brain that is processing pleasantness, and then the connection to other parts of the brain that are actually elaborating the features of a stimulus. So for sounds, we need auditory cortex, which is just behind our ears. And we need, for music, part of the brain that helps to understand movement. So even when we ask participants, please don't move, stay absolutely quiet in the scanner, then the participants are still moved by the music in a metaphorical sense, not just, you know, physical sense. And we see that in the brain. And this is quite different from what it's observed with paintings and landscapes, because it's actually the opposite. So when you find a painting ugly, then you want to move away, you want to withdraw, and then you are activating this part of the brain related to movement. But when if you find something visually beautiful, then you don't activate motor parts.
You just want to sit and stare at it.
Yes, yes.
I want to bring the choreographer in at this point, because, I mean, is that something you find, beautiful music makes people want to move?
Oh, most definitely. It's an impulse, and I think that music and movement is so closely intertwined, you know, a way of communicating, a way of expressing yourself.
Now, our listener, Elizabeth, wanted to know specifically about coordinated movements. Are there certain rules you can follow to make movement beautiful?
Yes. In working on a choreographic piece or a performance, there are certain rules that we use. We work with body and time and space. You use line and symmetry in that sense, but also in what pace it goes. Like, is it at the same time? Is it an echo?
We've got a video of one of your dances, which is really bad for radio, but for the benefit of our podcast and radio listeners, can you explain what's going on, what we're seeing here?
Yes, so this is from a piece called Cacao. It is three dancers on stage in a very symmetric space, and they work against and with the symmetry of the space, both in the placement in the room, but also maybe they will stand next to each other doing the same movement in unison, or maybe one will go to that place, do a movement, a while later the other dancer will go to the same place and do the same movement.
Would you say these dancers are actually following the rules or also breaking the rules?
Oh,
the choreography?
They're doing both, actually, in one big chaotic combination. for me, it's important to have a certain set of rules and then obstruct against them to see what happens.
Elvira, what do you say as a neuroscientist, when artists break rules, does the brain recognize that as beautiful?
Yeah, I mean, you can summarize it that way. And the point is that, yeah, you have to have a certain knowledge of the rules about what you are going to expect when you listen to music or when we watch dance choreography. And then when there is something against your expectations, then it can be actually a pleasant response. So the surprise can be really appreciated, but it has to go against something that is kind of stable. So if you actually break too much the rules, you end up disoriented. You don't know what to expect, and that is not pleasant anymore. So there is a sort of optimal amount of how much you can break rules.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And that's also like when you sit there as a choreographer trying to create a piece together with your crew, it's also like how big an obstacle or a challenge will you give the audience?
So this is all about how our brain works, because this kind of errors, so they are called reward prediction errors, they are known to activate dopaminergic neurons, which are related to our pleasure responses. And this gets activated when you know what to expect, but then you are surprised, so you get a reward when you don't expect it, then you have even more this activity. Yeah.
Thanks, Elvira. Coming to you next, Roger. You're a mathematician, so I want to ask you about the pleasure of symmetry and coordinated movement. Can maths help us understand why these things are beautiful?
Yeah, I think so. So what we find beautiful is very individual, but there are some underlying things. And one of the aspects of beauty is symmetry. And symmetry is something we can understand. Our left side is similar to our right side, and we see similar things all the time. And mathematics, ultimately, is the study of patterns. So one particular type of pattern is symmetry. So symmetry actually means together measure or together metric. So the word sim, if you're familiar with this word, means together. Like symbiosis is together life, and sympathy is together feeling. And symmetry has something to do with together measure. We have equal measure of something. Something is in harmony, something is in balance, something is in an equilibrium. So there's a sort of a harmony. And in mathematics, we can pinpoint certain kinds of symmetry very, very precisely. But it's ultimately about patterns.
Thanks, Roger.
Now we want to do a little experiment here. Elvira, people's tastes in music are really affected by their culture and individual experiences. But are there any pieces of music that everyone seems to like?
Yeah, we have also explored this question in a study. And we have selected a few pieces of music. And we asked our participants to decide how beautiful they are or how ugly they are. So basically, we identify the beautiful passages where all our participants, more than 40 people, agreed upon.
And also you found some music that actually nobody seems to find very beautiful.
Yes, exactly.
So I think we can listen to both these examples. Let's call them Music 1 and Music 2, and we'll see what you in the audience think about it. Let's hear Music 1. And let's go on to Music 2. So let us know what you're actually thinking. Hands up, who thinks Music 1 was beautiful? Almost everybody, I'd say. And who thinks Music 2 was beautiful? Yeah. A few people.
So it worked.
It worked.
Yeah, I mean, you exactly responded like our participants. So there was a huge consensus on the first bit of music and much less consensus on the other one. And the other one, it was actually mainly considered ugly by our participants. And these two excerpts come from the same piece, Adios Nonino by Astor Piazzolla. And it's a piece of music that we love, particularly as neuroscientists, because we have used it in several studies. And we also found that it's particularly liked overall, but some parts of it are really liked by all our participants.
Of course, most of the audience here is probably Swedish. And I think when you use this in your research, most of the participants were Finnish, right?
Yes, it's so right.
You would need to do it really with people from all over the world.
Yes, yeah, of course, it's a dream.
You're listening to Crowd Science from the BBC World Service, and this week we're in the middle of a shopping centre in Sweden at the Gothenburg International Science Festival.
We're discussing Crowd Science listener Elizabeth's question about why we appreciate beauty, and so far we've looked at how different kinds of beauty can give us pleasure. But Elizabeth was also interested in whether beauty might have evolutionary advantages.
So, Darwin had some things to say about this. He came up with the idea of mate choice and sexual selection, which is that males have to compete to attract females, and there's an advantage to beautiful adornments. Peacock's tails are the classic example of this. So even though these tails make them more vulnerable in terms of their survival because they have to lug a great tail around, there's an evolutionary benefit because they help them attract a mate.
And the thing is that we tend to find their tails very beautiful too, as well as lots of other things in nature. So what's going on here? Is there some ancestral pleasure circuit which triggers the same thing in us as it does in these other animals, you might wonder?
Before coming to Sweden, I spoke to a biologist who's very interested in these questions, and she's particularly interested in finding out if there's any connection between finding a mate attractive and appreciating a landscape. Is it the same sort of network going on? So she's been investigating something called the efficient coding theory of aesthetics.
Sounds complicated. What is that?
Okay, I will give this a shot. The basic idea is that our brains are wired to be really efficient at processing natural landscapes, and those are the landscapes that we evolved in. I'm going to introduce Tamara here. She can explain this better.
My name is Tamara Mendelson. I'm a professor of biological sciences at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and I study mate selection and its role in the origin of species in freshwater fishes. The efficient coding theory or hypothesis of aesthetics states that images are more pleasing to people when they match the spatial statistics or the underlying patterns of natural scenes because our sensory systems have evolved to efficiently process the landscapes that we've evolved in. Scientists who study aesthetic appreciation in humans, they've shown that natural landscapes, natural scenes, have a certain characteristic spatial pattern, spatial statistics that distinguish them from, say, anthropogenic scenes like a cityscape. So they've shown that images with the spatial statistic that matches natural scenes are preferred by people. They make them happy, they find them attractive. So they've shown that even with art, which is particularly cool, that even portraits of faces whose spatial statistics match the spatial patterns of natural landscapes are preferred by people. So what we're trying to do is apply these hypotheses that are being developed for human appreciation of art to Darwinian ideas of mate selection and sexual selection.
So if I get this right, the idea is we like images with similarities to natural landscapes just because they're easy for us to process?
I think that might be it. We have an English phrase which is easy on the eye. Is there a Swedish equivalent?
I don't think so, actually.
I've heard some brilliant Swedish phrases, something about the cow on the ice, but you don't have a easy on the eye. Well, basically, easy on the eye, according to this theory, easy on the eye is easy on your brain. I mean, it sounds a bit like your brain is pleased because when you're looking at someone handsome or beautiful, you're doing less work in your brain, and your brain is saying, I like this. And so Tamara is interested in whether the idea of finding a potential mate attractive might somehow be connected to the fact that we find landscapes more easy to process and therefore pleasing. And she's testing this by looking at a certain kind of fish called a darter.
Darters are small North American freshwater fishes. There's about 200 species of them. And each species is characterized by its own unique color pattern. Many different colors arranged in many different orientations. They're beautiful. One question is, do the fish themselves find them beautiful? We know that fish are attracted to them. So why are they attracted to them? And why are there so many different patterns? So we're testing this efficient coding theory of aesthetics. We're testing whether darter color patterns match the spatial statistics of the habitats in which they've evolved. So of those 200 species, some species will generally be found over small pea gravel. Some species will tend to be found in large boulders, and some will be found over sand. And then we ask, do the patterns of the darter colors match the spatial statistics of the habitat that they're in? And recent results suggest they do. So that's some preliminary evidence that the efficient coding theory might be operating, causing darter color patterns to evolve and causing darter color patterns to be attractive.
So they're evolving to match the patterns in their surroundings. That almost sounds like camouflage.
It's a weird one because you want to stand out. You don't want to be up against the wallpaper of the background, but then you don't want to stand out too much as a small fish because you'll just get eaten. This is research at quite an early stage, so there's definitely a lot going on here. Elvira, can I put this to you? Earlier you talked about the similarities and differences in our brains when appreciating beautiful music compared to beautiful pictures. And I'm just getting this feeling that instinctively there's some overarching concept of beauty, but in terms of why that evolved, are there lots of different reasons?
Absolutely. And there are actually several theories that are trying to explain why music has evolved in a certain way. And for example, music and, for example, rhythm, synchronization is very important for bonding within a group, so that for the tribes, like our ancestors, so that they could actually coordinate their actions, like in a war or, you know, or also really bonding within the tribe, within a certain group. And so this has also probably had an adaptive function, meaning that it's a feature that might have evolved over the years in our Homo sapiens species. Another possibility is that music could also be representing cognitive stimulus. So actually, it might be that complex music or something that is challenging our brains might be signaling who is the more intelligent partner, so for the survival of the fit, in a way. So these are just theories.
Thanks, Elvira. Now, finally, the theme of this science festival here in Gothenburg is astonishing thought. And the idea behind that is to look at human thought and artificial intelligence, or AI. That is, computers learning to think, more or less like we do. So for our purposes, we're interested in whether AI can appreciate beauty. Louisa, you have used AI in your work. So what was your idea?
Well, I'm married to an AI expert. So we had a dinner conversation, and I guess I challenged him if we could make an AI do choreography. So basically what we did was that I danced for hours and hours in front of a camera, and we took all that data and trained it on an AI to see what would come out at the other end. And I think we have some video. So after 10 minutes here, we see a lot of lines and dots in some kind of spasm in the middle of the air. And then after 6 hours, the AI kind of figured out some kind of body shape. There are legs and arms and some kind of stick figure body here. But it's still very insecure. It's a bit Bambi on ice. It doesn't really know how to move about. And then after 48 hours, we have a confident, somewhat happy stick figure dancing away, actually representing somewhat my choreographic style, but not the same. So it's actually given me something new.
So the algorithm could actually learn to do choreography. Would you say that it turned out to be just as good a choreographer as you?
Well, I would say a good assistant. I'm not hanging up my dancing shoes just yet, but it's a good assistance in giving me new ways of thinking about choreography, what would happen if I took the choreography out of the body and applied it on something else, an object, light, sound. So for me in my work, it's about exploring the next level of abstraction.
Thanks, Louisa, and I hope you find something beautiful in that. Roger, can I ask you, how good are computers at recognizing what we think of as beautiful?
Well, we can certainly train them. I mean, you can train a computer to detect patterns, and a computer can detect patterns you cannot detect yourself. That's pretty easy to see. I mean, we can make computers see patterns in faces or in nature, so why not train a computer to appreciate beauty? Does that mean it appreciates beauty and understands it? No. It just means that a computer is pattern matching in some sort of algorithmic way what we consider to be beautiful.
Can artificial intelligence influence what we think of as beautiful?
I think the answer is very obvious, and it's yes. Computers affect how we think about things. In general, tools affect how we think about things, and they have done so for very long. But computers and algorithms and now AI and deep learning and artificial intelligence and all these buzzwords, we have to think about what they really are. We make things move very, very quickly, and they in turn affect how we think about things. It makes us understand the world better, obviously, because we have tools, microscopes, computers. They can calculate faster than us. They can see deeper than us. They can see invisible things. But ultimately, you know, we are interacting with a thing, and we need to understand that interaction well. But to answer your question, at its best, artificial intelligence can make us better and increase our understanding of the world in a way that is very positive.
Thanks, Roger. Now, we do have time for a couple of quick questions. So Camilla is going to pick up a mic and go and rove in the audience. So does anyone have a quick question for our panel? Gentlemen here.
I would like to ask, because we as humans are pretty symmetrical, and when we choose a partner, that partner is also pretty symmetrical. So does that correlate with why we found symmetry beautiful?
Yes, it does. Because we like patterns. When we see something that reminds us of something, we recognize a pattern. So a lot of people find partners that are very similar to themselves. On one hand, this is a little bit lazy because you're not making an effort at all to go out of your comfort zone or look at different things. And it's just like with music. If all you listen to every day is jazz, you're probably going to listen to more jazz. And when somebody plays jazz, you're going to say, "Ooh, I like jazz," because you listen to it all the time. So if you look at yourself in the mirror a lot, you know, that's a little bit same thing.
Is this why people look like their pets?
Yes. And it's a little bit lazy because we tend to be attracted to patterns, and it gives us a sense of safety. So to answer the very first question too, why do we appreciate beauty? Well, there's a safety aspect to it. It's what we're used to.
Oh, how depressing.
Yeah.
Maybe go outside your comfort zone. That's all we've got time for. Thank you to our wonderful panel and our beautiful audience. Next week, Crowd Science is going to be finding out what the universe is made of. Just a small task there. We'll be visiting CERN in Switzerland, home of the Massive Particle Collider, the World Wide Web, and the Higgs boson. And we'll be asking if there are any limits to what physics can discover.
But from us here in Sweden, hej då.
Goodbye.
That's it for this edition of Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. This week's question was from me, Elizabeth Crayford, in Wellington, New Zealand. The program was presented by Marnie Chesterton and Camilla Wiedebeck and produced by Kathy Edwards, Louisa Field and Melanie Brown. If you have a science question, please email it to crowdscience@bbc.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Hello, me again to tell you about two great BBC World Service podcasts. You might already know them, The Hurricane Tapes and Fall of the Shah. Well, I've got news for you about both of them. The Hurricane Tapes is an investigation using previously unheard audio recordings telling the story of Reuben Hurricane Carter. He was a celebrity boxer, tried, convicted, and released twice for a triple murder he always denied committing. Fall of the Shah is our brilliant dramatic retelling of the 1979 Iranian Revolution, with consequences that are still being felt throughout the world today. Now, the news is that all the episodes have now been released. They're available in full, so you can just binge, listen to every episode whenever you want, one after the other. Just search for The Hurricane Tapes or Fall of the Shah wherever you found this podcast.